I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Senior American officials in the government and military have not been honest about the war in Afghanistan, now entering its 19th year. They made knowingly false statements touting progress on the ground and hid evidence that the war was essentially unwinnable. We know this now because the Washington Post fought the government in court to get documents detailing the concerns and criticisms of diplomats and generals. Reading through the Afghanistan papers, the title of the Post investigation, it's clear that leaders did not understand this country and didn't have a coherent policy for what to do after Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were defeated in 2001. 750,000 troops have fought in Afghanistan. There are still troops there now. 2,300 Americans have died. More than 20,000 were wounded. Today, the secret history of the war, what they did not want you to know. And we asked Craig Whitlock to join us. He's investigative reporter for The Washington Post, the lead author of this investigation. And Craig, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for doing all this work. What did it take to get these documents released? I know it has been a kind of a three-year battle in the courts.
That's right. So we started out just making a simple public records request with a government agency that had done these interviews. It's a special inspector general for Afghanistan. The records were unclassified, so we thought it was going to be a pretty straightforward request. But it turned into a real fight, and we had to keep pushing and pushing under the Freedom of Information Act and go to court twice to file lawsuits against that agency. And that's extraordinarily unusual. Those lawsuits cost a lot of money, take a lot of time, but fortunately the editors at the Post thought that it was worth it to keep pushing.
Well, it's interesting that this all began in the summer of 2016 when Michael Flynn, who was advising the Trump campaign at the time, apparently gave an interview to this SIGAR, the Office of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, a very critical interview about the war in Afghanistan.
Well, that's right. But we didn't know that at that point. I had just gotten a tip that Flynn had given an interview, and that interview had been unpublished. But Flynn at the time, you know, he was getting well known in political circles for his support of Trump and his dislike of Hillary Clinton. But when he was a general in the army, and particularly when he served in Afghanistan, he was pretty well respected for being a straight shooter on how things were going in the war in terms of military intelligence. So we were really curious what he said. And it took a long time and took a lawsuit. But once we got this interview, he was pretty unsparing in his criticism, particularly in how the war was being portrayed publicly and how that was completely at odds with the reality on the ground.
Give us an example of his critique.
Well, he would say that the diplomats, the generals, the White House officials, you know, they would all invariably, their reports would come out, say, you know, we're making progress, we're winning. And yet he said on the ground, when the reports first came in from the field, they were all saying, we're losing. And he said, you know, in a way, it was a crime. It was a crime the way the war was falsely portrayed from the senior levels of government.
We're talking about three administrations, the Bush, Obama, and now Trump administrations. Help us understand how a war can go on this long, especially when there's so much bad news on the ground.
Well, it's like the old saying, you know, it's a lot easier to start a war than it is to end one. And in this case, you know, there was a broad national consensus. There was a lot of support after 9/11 to do what President Bush ordered, which was to go into Afghanistan, topple the Taliban, and try and get rid of Al-Qaeda. The war started to stray pretty soon after that, and you know, people stopped paying that much attention. Things changed when Obama was president because we sent a lot more troops, but it just became very difficult to do two things. One, to extricate yourself militarily from a war that isn't going well, and two, so many generals, diplomats, presidents, members of Congress had invested themselves in this war and had supported it. It's very difficult politically for those people to say, you know what, it didn't work, we failed, we need to, you know, cut bait and get out.
Let me play a clip of President Bush announcing the invasion of the war in Afghanistan. This is October 7th, 2001, to destroy training camps, to disrupt communication, to make it harder to recruit Taliban followers. Let's give it a listen.
Our military action is also designed to clear the way for sustained, comprehensive, and relentless operations to drive them out and bring them to justice. At the same time, the oppressed people of Afghanistan will know the generosity of America and our allies. As we strike military targets, we will also drop food, medicine, and supplies to the starving and suffering men and women and children of Afghanistan. The United States of America is a friend to the Afghan people, and we are the friends of almost a billion worldwide who practice the Islamic faith. The United States of America is an enemy of those who aid terrorists and of the barbaric criminals who profane a great religion by committing murder in its name.
I mean, Craig, in many ways, such lofty and even inspiring words. This was, again, October 7th, 2001.
That's right. And at that point, like I said, you know, most people agreed with Bush, and not just in the United States. There are countries around the world, our NATO allies, other countries, even the Russians, totally understood why we were going into Afghanistan. The thing that changed is within 6 months, the Taliban had been toppled from power. Al-Qaeda had either – most of its leaders had either been killed, captured, or had fled Afghanistan, like Osama bin Laden did. So the rationale for the war, it shifted quickly. And it was at that point the objectives became a lot less clear. And that's when things really started to veer off from the original intent.
Reading through the Afghanistan papers, and I mentioned this in my introduction, I mean, it's pretty clear that policymakers, whether political or military, even diplomatic, truly did not understand this country. Is that your takeaway as well?
Well, it's not just my takeaway. I mean, read the interviews, and the people in charge of the war said, we didn't understand the country. There was an Army three-star general named Doug Lute, who was the Afghan war czar for both Bush and Obama in their White Houses. And he says, we lacked a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't have the foggiest idea of what we were undertaking. And, you know, that's a pretty striking comment to come from a general who was overseeing the war from the White House for two presidents. But he's not an outlier. Many, many people said we didn't understand the country, and even after 18 years, we didn't understand it. Because part of the problem was each year we'd send in a new rotation of troops, new rotations of diplomats, new rotations of aid workers. They'd spend 6, 9, 12 months there. They'd come home, and you'd get somebody else new going in. There was a memorable interview with an Afghan governor from Kandahar province who was very frustrated about this. He says, you know, the foreigners, they come in, they're reading the Kite Runner on the plane, and they think they understand Afghanistan, and they just don't.
I was going to raise the Kite Runner. As you say, this is something that's said in these papers, which is that was the way to understand this country, which, of course, it was written by an Afghan-born writer, but nonetheless did not tell the whole picture, that's for sure.
Well, that's right. And, you know, Afghanistan's a very different society from the United States. It's based on tribe, religion's extraordinarily important, and a lot of the cultural values there are really, so to speak, foreign to what's going on in the United States. And because we didn't have people who spoke the language or understood the culture, and, you know, and certainly I don't mean to diminish everyone. There were many people from the United States government who served in Afghanistan and did everything they could to help that country, but there wasn't much continuity, and that was certainly a problem.
Well, and I think it was the idea of the Marshall Plan that was used in Europe after World War II, which was to help rebuild a country that had had seen war, and as we know in Afghanistan, it had seen war for, frankly, decades.
Well, that's right. But that was, again, this wasn't a straight line how this worked. When Bush became president, he had campaigned on a platform of, quote unquote, no nation building. He had been very critical of President Clinton for using the military to try and build up nations in Haiti and Somalia and places in the Balkans. And he said he wasn't going to do that. And yet soon after he became president, the biggest nation-building project on earth fell into his lap in Afghanistan because the country had just been devastated even before the United States went in. So he was confronted with this dilemma. Do I go back on my campaign promise or what do I do? And the Bush administration never really resolved this. They knew that Afghanistan needed a lot of help, but they didn't want to spend the money. They wanted other countries or the UN to do it. And it took a while for the Bush administration to come around. Then when President Obama came in, he saw that the Bush administration hadn't done enough to help Afghanistan, but he went to the other extreme, and they spent so much money and so many billions of dollars that the country just couldn't possibly absorb it all. So we really went from one extreme to the other.
Let me play a clip, and this is Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. He's in Kabul. It's 2003, so just about 2 years after the start of the war, and he's alongside Afghan President Hamid Karzai.
President of the United States and General Franks and I have been looking at the progress that's being made in this country, and in cooperation with President Karzai have concluded that we're at a point where we clearly have moved from major combat activity to a period of stability and stabilization and reconstruction and activities.
Craig, did Donald Rumsfeld know what was going on in Afghanistan at the time?
Well, they didn't, because they thought the Taliban were defeated, and they thought that this was a more traditional war where they had vanquished the enemy. And I think they didn't really draw a distinction between Al-Qaeda, which was a small transnational terrorist organization, and the Taliban, which was, you know, while certainly extreme and brutal and odious in many ways, this was a local Afghan-led they had run the government in Afghanistan. This was based on Pashtun tribesmen, and this was not something they were going to defeat like they tried to do with Al-Qaeda. So, of course, the Taliban came back, and you hear Rumsfeld there talk about an end to combat activity, an end to combat operations. That was a line we heard from him in 2003, 15 years ago. But it was also a line that we heard from President Obama multiple times in 2014, 2015, 2016. He and his people kept talking about, you know, no more combat for U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. They would just be there to advise the Afghans. But it just patently wasn't true. We've had soldiers there dying all along, yet despite the leaders telling the American people that, oh, don't worry, we're not involved in combat anymore. It's just sort of laughable.
Craig, we're almost up on a break here. How many U.S. troops are in Afghanistan today?
So there's about 13,000, but in a sign of how badly the war has gone, the Pentagon nowadays doesn't even confirm how many troops they have there. They don't want to specify. The best number we can put on it is about 13,000. That's several thousand more than were there when President Obama left office. So even though we don't hear about the war very much, it's actually escalated the past few years.
And that's Craig Whitlock. He's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post, lead author of this Post investigation, the Afghanistan Papers. These are essentially interviews and reports that have been kept from the public. The Washington Post took the government to court using all sorts of court procedures in order to get this published, and now it has been published. We're going to talk more after this short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Arnie Moskowain, talking with Craig Whitlock. He's an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. We are talking about the Afghanistan Papers. These are papers documenting concerns and misinformation that was withheld from the American public, concerns by military leaders and also political leaders that the war was not winnable. And we are talking about what has been discovered from some of these documents. Craig, how much money has been spent so far in Afghanistan on Afghanistan?
That's a tough question to parse out because the federal government doesn't like to add it up comprehensively. The best number I can give you is just under $1 trillion, that's adjusted for inflation, has been spent by the Defense Department, State Department, USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, just those three departments on operations in Afghanistan. Most of that has been for military operations or defense contracts, but that's about $1 trillion. Now, that doesn't count a lot of other expenses like the CIA or other intelligence agencies or the cost of medical care for veterans who were wounded in Afghanistan, or costs on the debt of the loans we've had to take out to pay for the war, those costs escalate pretty quickly. But just direct expenses in Afghanistan itself have been about $1 trillion.
And of course, spent on an extremely poor country. There are a number of anecdotes about warlords who were given money. There was one warlord in particular named Dostum, who was receiving $100,000 a month for what?
Well, it sort of memorably put in one of these interviews, it was to stay out of trouble. That's what they were giving him money for. General Dostum, as they call him in Afghanistan, he's a warlord from the northern part of the country. And he was instrumental in working with the CIA and U.S. Special Operations Forces in late 2001 to fight the Taliban and al-Qaeda. But after the Taliban was toppled, he became a key part of the government. And he's kind of he's a warlord, right? You know, he's not a nice guy. He's been accused of rape, murder, and torture. And I don't mean that lightly. I mean, the allegations against him are pretty appalling. But this was a guy who ended up becoming a vice president of Afghanistan. To this day, he's a vice president of Afghanistan. And he became a very close ally of the United States. He wrote Christmas cards to President Bush. He's just the other day, the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan visited him to give him a medal that they draped over him. So, you know, these are the kind of people we're friends with, unfortunately, in Afghanistan.
Talking about staying out of trouble, was it to buy his loyalty or what?
Well, I don't think it was to buy his loyalty. It was to prevent him from mounting a coup or from stirring unrest against the Afghan government. So that kind of trouble.
Well, and Karzai, who was president for some time, had a fair number of critics within the government. What was their concern about him?
Well, that he was a weak figure. He couldn't control the warlords. But among other things, he couldn't control his own family. There were a lot of allegations against some of his brothers. One of his half-brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, was sort of a strong man in Kandahar province and was always suspected by the United States of drug running and doing all sorts of illicit things. He was later killed in an assassination. Another one of Karzai's brothers is a businessman who was a key shareholder of Kabul Bank, which was the biggest bank in the country that almost melted down in this enormous corruption scandal. And Mahmoud Karzai, the president's brother, had profited a lot from that.
You know, I remember early on in the war when Karzai was being introduced to the world, I guess, or certainly introduced to the American public, and the hat he wore and the kind of clothing that he wore, and this idea that this was the man who was going to bring democracy to Afghanistan.
Well, and he did, in a manner of speaking, and he's still respected by a number of people. President Karzai speaks English very well. He's very suave. He's very well educated. He's from the South, from a tribe, the Popalzai tribe, that carries a lot of weight. But what the problem with President Karzai really hit home in 2009 during his reelection campaign, there was just this massive ballot box stuffing campaign. All observers said this was a fraudulent election on a massive scale. And yet he was our ally in Afghanistan, and the United States helped prop him up despite this extraordinarily corrupt election. And you know, so for a guy who is supposed to bring democracy to Afghanistan, that's not the kind of democracy we usually like. But we were stuck with him. And so he stayed in office. And that really, you know, put a real black mark on the name of democracy in Afghanistan to Afghans themselves.
We've been talking a lot, essentially about the failures in Afghanistan. But have there been successes? I'm thinking, for instance, of the numbers of girls who have been educated or even women who've been elected to government.
Yeah, no doubt that there have been successes socially, economically. The country, the economy has grown. People have more freedoms. Kabul is just an entirely different city than it was 20 years ago. You know, in 2001, before the United States went in, Afghanistan was just a wreck of a country. It had been involved in war since the Soviets had invaded in 1979. It was a really, really I'm running out of adjectives to describe just how devastated it was. So it's come a long way. But the thing that hasn't come a long way is the stability of the government. We tried to create a central Afghan government, a democracy that today still has very little support among the population. They see it as corrupt. And many people support the Taliban, brutal as they are, because they don't see the Afghan government as being any better.
A number of people in this report talk about the Taliban, and we are apparently in negotiations with the Taliban today. But it sounded as if early on in the war we were conflating the Taliban and al-Qaeda. But I think it was Barnett Rubin that said that there really was a difference between these two groups.
Well, they are. The Taliban, for the most part, are Afghans. There are also Pashtun fighters with the Taliban who are from Pakistan. But, you know, they're from that region. Al-Qaeda is a transnational terrorist group led by bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Egyptian. But Al-Qaeda were mostly Arabs in those days. These were foreigners not from Afghanistan or Pakistan. So there was a big difference there. As Barnett Rubin and others say, the United States really missed an opportunity in 2001, 2002, 2003 when the Taliban had been toppled from power. There was an opportunity there to negotiate with them while they were on their heels to cut some sort of deal that would incorporate them into the Afghan government or at least the political system, that Taliban leaders were willing to talk. And the United States said no. They saw them as terrorists, as an enemy, and that, you know, why negotiate with terrorists? Now, today, of course, as you point out, President Trump has directed the State Department to negotiate directly face-to-face with the Taliban. So if we had done this 16 years ago, maybe the war wouldn't have taken so long.
That is Craig Whitlock, again, investigative reporter for The Washington Post, lead author of this investigation, the Afghanistan Papers, about information that has been withheld from the American public, concerns about failures in fighting the war and in nation building in Afghanistan. Let's talk a little about infrastructure. And part of the Afghanistan Papers describes a project where in a certain part of Afghanistan, people were paid a fair amount of money to dig ditches. And as it turned out, a number of teachers figured out that they would get paid more to dig ditches than to educate children. And it had a kind of unintended consequence. Can you talk about that?
Sure. This was in Kandahar province about 2010, 2011. And, you know, it wasn't a large-scale project, but it sort of typified, according to the documents we obtained, it sort of typified our lack of knowledge of how Afghanistan operated on a local level and how it functioned tribally and socially, that we went in some cases, with very good intentions trying to help out the Afghans, but because we didn't understand the economy or the culture or the social networks, that we ended up making things worse. So on one hand, we're building schools, new schools, to try and get girls in education, try and get young Afghan boys in education. But then we're also looking for make work projects. So we'd pay for, people, $80 a month to dig ditches. So then in Kandahar, in this one project, all the teachers said, well, we're going to make a lot more money digging ditches. So they left the school. So we have, teachers digging ditches and empty schools and, the exact opposite of what we intended.
How about roads and other parts of infrastructure? Is Afghanistan different today than it was 20 years ago?
No question. I mean, again, 20 years ago, it was very difficult to travel around Afghanistan. I mean, physically, there were no roads, or the roads had been bombed out. There hadn't been any new construction in so long. And this is one thing the United States tried to do. And in some ways, it was helpful. They tried to rebuild the economy. And one of the things we focused on were building roads and highways. But because as the Taliban returned and as the war re-intensified starting in 2004, 2005, 2006, and ever since, all these public works projects that the United States and its allies had spent money on quickly you know, they fell into disrepair, or, you know, there were Taliban checkpoints, or we ended up bombing our own project. So because the war was ongoing, it was very hard to keep building up the country. We take one step forward and two steps back.
Ambassador Crocker, who was U.S. ambassador, I guess, to Afghanistan, said the biggest lesson learned for me is don't do major infrastructure projects.
Yes, and I think what he's referring to there are things like highways and dams and things like this for a couple of reasons. One, you know, it costs so much money for the Americans to pull off, and it's difficult to do in a foreign country like that. But he said, you know, the Afghans just weren't equipped to maintain these on their own. It would be one project he was talking about in particular is called the Kajaki Dam, which was a big hydroelectric dam in the southern part of the country in Helmand province. And the American military wanted to rebuild this dam so that we could produce electricity to people in the southern part of Afghanistan. And so they spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to do this. One big problem was that the Taliban still controlled the territory around the dam. So we would have to send in, you know, armored convoys of engineers trying to fix this dam. And it's taken 15 years to get it operational. And even then, you know, this is a kind of project the Afghans don't have their own staff or technology to make sure that they can keep it going. So he was saying it's a waste of money to do something so big that the Afghans can't take care of themselves.
Well, let's talk about the opium trade, which was and apparently still is very much a part of the Afghanistan economy. And the idea, at least early on, was to try to convince the people to grow a different kind of crop. Where do things stand today when it comes to poppy production?
Well, it's really bad. So this is something that was bad historically in Afghanistan to begin with. Afghanistan had always been a leading supplier of opium to the world. And opium, of course, is used to make heroin and other drugs like morphine. And they would grow this in poppy fields. Ironically, the Taliban had almost put a stop to the production of opium back in 2000. They decreed that it was un-Islamic. Then we went in 2001, and in the war, this became, again, an unintended backlash to what happened. Was the poppy production has since skyrocketed, and there's far more opium poppy grown now than at the beginning of the war, despite billions of dollars in counter-narcotics efforts that the United States, Britain, and other allies have spent.
And there's just more money in poppy production than in another crop?
Far more. And the Afghans are very good at growing growing opium, and it's far more profitable than things like wheat or pomegranates. I mean, the United States would tried very hard to get the Afghans to grow other crops, but, you know, the Afghans would say, okay, I'll grow some wheat here, but then they would plow another field somewhere else and put poppy in it, or they would grow some fruit trees. But then, you know, the opium was always much more profitable. And this, we ended up changing our policies back and forth. Some years we would go in and try and eradicate the poppies, but then that would make the Afghan farmers really angry at the United States. So we stopped doing that and tried to get them to grow other crops. But it's just sort of a policy mess. And the opium poppy production has just boomed since then.
I played a clip of President Bush. I do want to play a clip of President Obama. This is in his first State of the Union address, 2009, where he talks about Afghanistan.
When I took office, we had just over 32,000 Americans serving in Afghanistan, compared to 160,000 in Iraq at the peak of the war. Commanders in Afghanistan repeatedly asked for support to deal with the reemergence of the Taliban, but these reinforcements did not arrive. And that's why, shortly after taking office, I approved a long-standing request for more troops.
So that's President Obama in 2009. Here he is in 2014, another State of the Union address talking about Afghanistan.
When I took office, nearly 180,000 Americans were serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, all our troops are out of Iraq. More than 60,000 of our troops have already come home from Afghanistan. With Afghan forces now in the lead for their own security, our troops have moved to a support role. Together with our allies, we will complete our mission there by the end of this year. and America's longest war will finally be over.
So, Craig, that was 2014. That was 5 years ago.
Right. And, you know, we've heard this time again. I think this is part of why the American people have paid less attention to Afghanistan, because their leaders have told them that the war is over. I mean, you heard Obama there saying, you know, the mission's going to come to an end. We're going to pull all our troops out. We're not in the fight anymore. The Afghans are doing the fighting, which, you know, is not much different from what Donald Rumsfeld said in 2003. But it just wasn't true. Obama, I think, was trying to pull troops out, but he just couldn't pull it off. And this idea that Americans were not there fighting, you know, frankly, that was just fiction in a lot of word games. The Americans have been there fighting. They've been conducting counterterrorism operations. And the air wars now, you know, under President Trump, the Pentagon has been dropping more bombs in Afghanistan each month than they did under most of President Obama's 8 years in office. So we don't hear about the war as much. We don't have as many troops here as we used to, but the war is going on as intensely as ever.
And we don't hear about it for the same reason that these papers reveal that no one really wants to talk about it and hear how difficult it is.
Well, I think that's true. So, you know, in our case, when we tried to obtain these documents, it took us 3 years to get these documents that interview people telling the truth about the war. But, you know, another example today, the commander of U.S. military forces in Afghanistan, General Scott Miller, you know, he's been in position there for 15 months. I don't think he's given a single press conference or appeared in public or even before Congress in a public setting since he took that role. So there's a real concerted effort to not draw attention to what's going on there.
That's Craig Whitlock. He's investigative reporter for The Washington Post. We are talking about the Afghanistan papers, lead author for this investigation. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be joined by Peter Lucier. He's been listening in. He served in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2011 to 2013, and we'll get his take on the Afghanistan papers. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking with Craig Whitlock about his investigative series in the Washington Post, The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. The paper published previously unpublished interviews that have been conducted by the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction for their Lessons Learned project. And they reveal flawed and conflicting strategies, lack of planning, mismanaged money, doubts and criticisms from diplomats and high-ranking military, all kept from the public until now. Peter Lucier wrote about his reaction to the series and how he is wrestling with the lies about the war. He's a Marine, served in Afghanistan from 2011 to 2013. And Peter Lucier, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. What has been your reaction to the Afghanistan papers?
Anger and sadness. When it first came out, I didn't know the report was coming, and I woke up in the morning when it was the front page of the Post, and it was frustrating because it was laid out so clearly and so in depth by this really incredible reporting and all the stuff that came from SIGAR, but it was nothing that I hadn't known kind of intuitively through my own lived experience. And then also, that had been known to like veterans who had served there. It was nothing that we haven't known and been talking about for a long time. So to see, that level of honesty had existed and hadn't been made public, was really, really frustrating. And then it's sad too. I stay in touch with a lot of my veteran friends, and for a lot of them, it's re-traumatizing. It brings back all of their moral injuries and their struggle with the war, it's hard to heal those wounds and move on. One, when the war is still being fought, and then two, when it's taken like a 3-year legal battle to get access to people finally telling the truth about the war that we fought in.
Does it help in any way, Peter, that this is, even though it was kept from you, it was kept from the public, but to know that the truth is out there, does that in any way, as you said, on the ground, you knew a lot of this, but does it help to have it out in the public for us to see and hopefully understand?
It does. I think it makes it easier when that information is more accessible, and it's, you know, getting outside of just kind of like military and national security realms, where a lot of like, you know, turning a corner in Afghanistan or the progress we're making in Afghanistan in those circles, that's been a joke for a really long time. We trace how many times it's been said that, you know, we've turned a corner by a general or by a senior official, or whenever somebody gets up and talks about the progress we've made, you know, in our circle, we laugh at that because it's been the same old song for a very long time. But part of kind of the healing process that needs to happen is we need to be able to talk about that with our friends, our families, our neighbors who are still removed from kind of this 20-year war, because it's such a small segment of the population that has had firsthand account of it. And so to them, the narrative has been, well, like, things must be getting better over there. Like, there must be something worthwhile that we're doing or that we're accomplishing. And so having this report made public, it's easier to turn to, you know, your spouse, your friends, your parents, and have them kind of understand that your frustration isn't just, you know, trauma from fighting a war, sure, but fighting a war that went so poorly. Yeah.
Peter, I want to get back to you, but Craig, have you heard from other either Marines or soldiers who fought in Afghanistan?
Yes, many, countless almost. You know, and Peter's one of them. He wrote a first-person story for the Post recently reflecting on his service there. And I think, I certainly don't mean to speak for him, but many of the veterans we've heard for have, you know, they fought or they served in Afghanistan under the premise that they were doing so for a higher purpose, for the national interest, and because, you know, our country's leaders had told them this was, you know, incredibly important. And yet to hear these same leaders in these confidential interviews admit that they didn't know what they were doing, or there was no strategy, or that things didn't add up, you know, that's just a real breach of faith, to say the least, with the men and women who served there and did their best to do their duty for our country. So, you know, I think that's, I hate to say it, but there's a real rupture there, sure, in trust and faith between the people in charge and the people who served.
And Peter, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is I was just so moved by what you wrote in the Washington Post. It's headlined, "I fought in Afghanistan as a Marine. Here's how I am wrestling with the lies of the war and my Catholic faith." Help us understand your Catholic faith and how that has created some inner turmoil for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I got, home from Afghanistan in 2012, all of that kind of like anger and confusion, I'd really kind of bought into, you know, being a Marine. It was something I really wanted to do and do well. And, I really kind of believed in this mission that I was going to fight. And then having like lived experience of war, everything I had thought and kind of had believed in had been kind of undercut by this incredible like confusion and the lack of a mission, and nothing over there had seemed to make sense. And so I was really kind of lost, and eventually, after, you know, stumbling through that for a really long time, I was raised Catholic, and I had come back to I found my way back into a church and a faith life, and through kind of reading and interacting with other vets who were talking about faith and service, just for myself, I found it's really old kind of Catholic practice of penance, which kind of starts with like lament and acknowledging that you've done wrong in kind of a public way, doing some kind of penance to kind of like fix yourself, and then doing some reparative work in the world. And so for myself, that was really helpful. I kind of had this writing that I did that publicly acknowledged like my own kind of like culpability for partaking in war, you know, doing some kind of meaningful penance and then trying to do some reparative work to make the world better, and how it fits with the Pentagon Papers, or the Afghanistan Papers, is that lament, that public acknowledgement that something was wrong, that this didn't work, that we were culpable in perpetuating a war badly, at the very least kind of mismanaging it, had yet to really happen and still seems to not be happening. The reaction to the Afghanistan Papers from some Department of Defense officials has still been kind of like denial. And so we're preventing that healing process for so many veterans when we fail to have that kind of like public acknowledgement.
I mean, penance is such a powerful thing. And I want to go back to you, Craig Whitlock. And as Peter was describing the kind of penance that he was going through, I'm thinking in many ways that's something we all should do. We all are complicit in this war in one way or another.
I think that's true, that in one way or another. But I have to say that I think some people are more complicit than others.
Right.
I think the American people and people who served were taking their cues and taking words at face value that came from our leaders. And when we see our leaders saying very different things in private than they were in public, that's a difficult thing for many people to swallow. So, yes, as a nation, we're all responsible. But when our leaders are making these decisions and telling us why, and it doesn't add up, you know, that's a different sort of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, Peter, if there were, you know, a military leader, and there are many that are in this in these Afghanistan Papers, what would you want to tell them if you could, you know, have an hour with one of them?
Oh boy.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's okay. So my first start in writing was actually back in 2015, and I was given an opportunity by a really incredible journalist who used to work at the Post. His name's Tom Ricks.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, really, really incredible. And he put together a group of kind of junior enlisted veterans, people who were kind of E5 and below, sergeants and below, people who had, you know, partook in Iraq and Afghanistan kind of at a ground level, and wanted to incorporate their voices into the national security discussion, because he thought that we really had something to offer about, you know, firsthand accounts of war needed to be more of a part of when we talked about national security. And one of the first projects that we got put on was an essay contest, and it was 500 words or less, why did we lose Afghanistan?
Wow.
This was 4 years ago.
Wow.
It was widely acknowledged in kind of this national security community, and there were dozens of submissions from, you know, officers who are kind of career officers and senior government officials, and everybody was talking about in this real short essay form. And I wrote a response at the end of it that said that one of the things for me that was really healing about that experience was just the honesty of it, was for people to say and admit in a really kind of frank way, like, that we had lost, that in 2015 it was acknowledged, like, we had not achieved our strategic objectives, and we were not likely to achieve them, and we were kind of swimming in shallow water kind of blindly. And so if I could sit with one of these, you know, people for an hour, I would say, you know, I'm really glad that you were honest with the SIGAR interviewer, but if you could, you know, make that honesty public, if you could just talk about, yes, like, we failed, yes, I failed, that public acknowledgement, I think, would be so powerful and so useful, not just for veterans, but for everyone who's been affected by this war. It's not just veterans. There's, you know, tens of thousands of Afghan civilians who have been killed in this war, this year more than any other year that the war has gone on. There's so much trauma on all sides of war, and just that starting point of admitting, like, this was, the mistakes were made, I think would be a place to start.
Craig, let me go back to you. And actually, my TV is on here, and there's you know, debating impeachment, which of course is very important. But are you concerned that what you have written and published is going to get lost in all the news that is not related to the Afghanistan war?
No, I'm not. We've actually had I think our series has really struck a chord with more readers than we had ever imagined would take the time to read through some really long articles, but we tried to present it in a way that was digestible and would, you know, would strike a chord with people. I think we've succeeded in that. And I think, you know, just by this show and others, people are sort of hungering for a real conversation about what's gone on in Afghanistan, but a real honest conversation. And I think that's been missing from the debate for a long time.
But do you is there a way? I'll put this to both of you, but let me start with you, Craig. I mean, is there a way out of this war? We're about to enter our 19th year.
Well, it's going to be tough. There's no easy way out. President Trump is the first president of the three who have waged war in Afghanistan to have direct negotiations with the Taliban. You know, we'll see what happens with that. That's not an easy thing to pull off. But, you know, all the U.S. military leaders in command for a few years now said the only way to end the war is to resolve it in the political sphere. And they mean by that by having negotiations with the opposition or the enemy, which in this case is the Taliban. That's always been a tough line to cross for a lot of reasons, but you know, at least they're trying at this point. We'll see where that goes. It's not going to be easy, but you know, that's the big change. In the past year, there have been direct negotiations with the Taliban.
I mean, Peter, you were there 2011 to 2013. Do you see now in 2019, almost 2020, a way out of this war?
It's tough. The areas that I fought in are under Taliban control and have been since about 2013. So I left in 2012. We were replaced by another Marine unit who had a very short deployment. They turned that area where we fought in Helmand over to the Afghan National Security Forces, and within a couple months it was overrun. Helmand is mostly under the control of the Taliban now. I don't know how we get out of it without hurting a large number of people. I think like really immediate withdrawals can be really problematic. I think two things. One, are necessary to kind of start that process. The first is congressional oversight. I'd like to see more congressional oversight of like the conduct of the war itself. And I think that helps bring things to a close, because you can have public hearings and that political pressure can help move the ball forward. And then the second, if we're going to end it, there needs to be really clear kind of command intent from the highest levels of government that start putting our really, talented public servants who work in this sector, just let them know what you want. Let them know from the top levels of government that we want to end this thing responsibly and turn some of those really great national security minds towards finding solution. And then the third thing is that absolutely, yeah, I think like peace talks with the Taliban, every expert says it's absolutely necessary. And I think it's going to be a key part of bringing the conflict to a close.
Craig, are there more papers to come?
Yes, we
more
hope
documents?
So. Yes, there are hundreds more interviews that the Inspector General has done. There are all that we haven't obtained yet that we're in court to obtain those, as well as the names of many 200 or so others that were on the documents we did obtain. The names were redacted. We're still fighting in court for all of those.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. Peter Lucier, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a Marine veteran. He writes about faith and service. Craig Whitlock, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's an investigative reporter at The Washington Post, a lead author of the Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.